Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the TakeCast. My name is Davis Matic. You guys can find me on Twitter at Davis Matic. In this episode of the show, I'm joined by fan favorite, my buddy, Sammy Reed, to, discuss poker. A lot of us are sitting at home, been spending a lot of time at home, so I've been playing more cards. You know, it is statistically true that poker revenues for online sports, online poker rooms in the United States of America are basically, up. Month over month, 100-200%, depending on where you are. So certainly don't think it can be argued that a lot of you guys are playing cards. So that's what this episode of the show is about, strategy, kind of the differences between playing online and live, some cash game tips, just kind of, just some general online poker or poker overall talk. So hope that you guys enjoy it. I had a lot of fun talking to Sammy. I think that he's really sharp, has a really good understanding of how to win at these games, and we will just continue to do more content as long as all of us are stuck here at home. If you want to subscribe to patreon.com/takecast for bonus episodes of the show, you can, or if you just want to leave a rating and review on iTunes, that's very useful and helpful as well. And now we'll go ahead and get into the episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TakeCast, bringing in my buddy, Sammy Reed. Clean shaven right now, looking surprisingly young. It's kind of throwing me off. If I'm going to be honest about it, you look a little bit too young. But people enjoyed the first poker cast, and back when we recorded that, everyone was able to leave their house. Everyone was able to go to casinos to go and play. They were able to, just sort of enjoy their lives. And now, Sammy, everyone's playing cards online. People are playing on Global. People are playing on private sites with their buddies. Some people are playing in the free money games with their buddies and settling up, offline. Just, a lot of different ways that people are playing. So we are going to talk cards again. We're going to talk some of our experiences playing online, what it used to be like, what it's like now, and how have you found the online cards?
I found it great, and I think one of the troubles being out there is that most of the sites are very sketch. You have a bunch of unregulated sites that you can jump on that are public, and then you have like private games, but the private games are really up to like the agent, and they're handling all the money, and it's like, okay, is this guy running this like a Ponzi scheme? Like, there's, whenever you have a new ecosystem, like you kind of do with online poker right now, it is going to be rife for people taking advantage and acting shady. And so you kind of have to balance that with, hey, I need to get my poker fix in.
Yeah. People just, they have the time, right? People just, they have the time. And my experience is that a lot of people, obviously, my age, played poker in high school with their buddies. They played on Full Tilt and Stars or whatever.
Yeah, I just played Pinochle in high school, so.
Right. Gin Rummy. Right. and my experience is that many of them just stopped playing, or maybe they'd play, I would say on average, most people have not gone to a casino to play cards, but have played with their dad, with their buddies or whatever in a home game. And that would be the extent of it. Whereas I think, before Black Friday, post Moneymaker, it would have not have even been a weird thing to go to a casino to go play cards. Like that would have been a normal thing. Whereas like that was like definitely a niche thing the last 5 years.
Yeah, that's 100% true. And so you have these groups of players, especially from other countries, that have continued to grind online. And then you have these influx of Americans who are like, oh yeah, I'm just going to go play some No Limit Hold'em online. And they have no shot against these
dudes. The game done changed, dude. The game. So like I read, when I first got into poker, I read Super System and, Harrington on Hold'em, Sklansky's books, David Sklansky's first couple books, I would say were much closer to the core concepts of what guys are getting at now with all the computers and the solvers and everything. But yeah, still, even granting that Sklansky's books were ahead of their time, he would have read, Play Optimal Poker by Andrew Brokos or, some of Ed Miller's, like, not the course, but some of Ed Miller's, like, more advanced stuff, and just been like, what?
What? Like, what? What, bro?
Yeah, like, so you should explain, I think, to the people who are coming back to poker now, just like, what's happened in the last 10 years? What has fundamentally changed with the way the game is understood at like a high level?
Okay, so I'd say the major thing is that people, like good players, have adopted a frequency-based approach. And what that means is, like, most players, they look at their hand and they think, how should I play this hand, right? It makes sense. You look down at your cards, how should I play these cards? What players have really done over the last 10 years is understood that poker is a game just like anything where the mathematics of it dictate proper plays. And so players have been playing their ranges rather than their specific hands and understanding that those ranges need to be put in certain buckets. On the flop, you should be calling with X amount of hands. And then they go into a program and figure out what X amount of hands look like.
Pio solver, which I thought about like trying to run it like for maybe the course of like setting up a hand for this or something. And I was like, I don't even like, I wouldn't even know what to do once I got in it. I don't know if I would be able to set it up.
If you ever try to work with the Pio solver, it's kind of like reading hieroglyphics. You're trying to like figure out poker hands in hieroglyphics, which is, it's very difficult. Like you really have to be acclimated to it to be able to even figure out what it's doing.
Yeah. So and again, you know, from the outside, kind of as I understand it, it's that instead of thinking of like hands in terms of groups or in thinking like, and also in, you know, those old, those old books on, you know, cash games or whatever, a lot of it would be talking about implied odds, pot odds. Like you call a straight when the implied odds of, or you call with a straight, an open-ended straight draw based on, you know, how many cards you can get there based on how many cards you can win on the bet. And like, that was like a lot of the math then. That is mostly outdated now, I would think.
Yeah. I mean, it's just very basic. And the reality is when you make a straight, you know, 32% of the time, when you have an open ender on the flop, it's like, yeah, okay, but who gives a shit? Because there's so much money behind. Like, we're all dealing with implied odds anyway. Who cares what's just going to happen, like, on the next card? Like, it doesn't really matter, I'd say. So
it's just weird.
Yeah, I mean, and people really have their ranges and frequencies figured out, especially online. I mean, there are charts of, okay, I'm opening these hands from this position, and I'm three betting these hands at this frequency, and I'm bluffing the river at this frequency, and really understanding balance. Whereas in the past, like, players just did not understand how to create balanced betting strategies, and now players do. And for somebody just coming in and saying, oh, I like poker, I'm going to play my hand, they're just like, they're playing a whole different game, and they're in big trouble.
Yeah, so I sort of, funnily enough, I think it like really micro stakes, just the I'm gonna play group one, group two hands. Like if you were just like, I'm literally never playing anything worse than ace 10 suited, I think you could maybe grind out a profit in some of these online games, in the cash games, just because, I mean, people are always gonna be bad, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, one of the big weaknesses of all players is that they play too many hands, but, like, just playing good hands isn't enough. You know what
right.
I mean? Like, you have to, you know, take a hand that everybody likes to play, 7-6 suited. The way most players play this hand is they're trying to, like, make a big hand with it. They're trying
yeah,
to
you,
flop
you,
two
they're
pairs
playing,
straight.
You're playing, so with you're playing, there was a really, I was just reading a book the other day, and they had like an interesting term for this. It's like flop or fold poker. So like either, you know, the flop smacks you in the face or you fold.
Yeah,
and
fitter fold.
And that's probably not, I mean, maybe that used to, you know, would have been a good strategy 10 years ago. Against like, you know, like mega whales, but it's not going to work now.
No, it just ain't it. Like, you don't make hands enough, whereas you should be looking at suited connectors. Your very first instinct with suited connectors would be, how do I turn this hand into a bluff, right? If you end up making a good hand with it, cheers, all the better. But your very first instinct should be, if I play this hand, I'm going to look for opportunities to bluff with it, which is exactly the opposite of what most players do. They think, I'm going to try to make a big hand with this hand. And it's like, okay, you can play good hands, but at the end of the day, if you're not like bluffing enough and have your betting frequency sorted out, you're just not going to make enough money.
All right. So we can get into some nitty gritty talk here in a little bit for sure. You know, I'll let you go with super, super intense poker strategy, but I want to pull back a little bit for sure, which is, I think a lot of people listening to this, probably 30 to 50% of the people listening to this, they're just playing the DFS Poker Open on Global Poker. Like I would say they're like, yeah, like I'm enjoying playing cards. I got some money on Global Poker.
Right. And I'm enjoying it. Sweep coins. They're playing sit and goes and like,
yeah, you know, yeah. So, I mean, just first off, like, have you enjoyed playing in the DFS Poker Open? Like I love like looking forward to playing it. I wish they were doing it this week and they're not.
I feel like I'm a bad employee if I say no. But I mean, the reality is it's like, you know, whatever, a 15 person, like hyper turbo multi-table tournament where after the first hour, if you have starting stack, you're like at 10 big blinds.
Not even.
So, I mean, yeah, it's fun to like mix it up with people in the industry and have fun and this and that, but I don't think it really accurately reflects like real poker that much. And I'm kind of a big poker nerd. So for me, it's like not as fun as like most of the games I'm playing right now, if I can just like be fully real about it.
So what is, do you like sit and goes the most? Do you like MTTs, like cash? Like what is your preferred style?
I like deep stack cash games. So cash games where you're 150, 200, 250 big blinds deep. That's kind of like, that's kind of what I've been playing live for the last couple of years. And so to be able to find games like that online, I think is what I want to play the most. And I don't just want to like throw, you know, $10 in and try to, you know, win a big tournament like that, you know, whatever. I would rather sit down with a bunch of money and start getting down in cash games. So that's kind of my jam.
Why is that? Why do you prefer that to just because you like you hate the variance of the MTTs?
Yeah, I mean it's kind of lame to like play for like 3 hours and then you get it all in with ace king and sevens and you you're like what am I doing with my life? What did I just do for the last 3 hours?
Like literally, I've just been sitting here all day. I won a couple big pots. Oh, I lost the big pot. Oh, I have 8 big blinds. I have ace king. Get it in. Oh, I didn't make any money.
Right. To me, it's just kind of like, it's a waste of time. I would rather play games where, I'm just like constantly in the action and, you know, I play for 3 hours and I feel like I did something productive with my time. Obviously, if you take down the tournament, like you're pumped, you know, you won 4 figures or whatever and, you know, it's great on $10, like that's super. But for me, it's just like that small chance of, I mean, if there's 1,500 people in a tournament, even if you're 3 times as good as the average player, you have a 1 in 500 chance of winning it. Like, I'd rather just like play like positive EV poker and play cash games and.
Well, you are EV positive, right?
That's right. they do have a test for that. I came up positive for EV.
Yeah, so yeah, that's one. It's one of the tests that you
imagine if I still had that freaking poker handle.
You'd be crushing right now. Why aren't you starting a poker coaching website right now? Feels like that would be a great way to you know handle some of your spare time. There's got to be. I wonder how poker coaching websites are doing during this. They have to be like I saw that in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, which is, you know, just straight up regulated legal onside legal online poker. Their poker revenues are up 100% month over month. Like
so it, hot.
Like literally like doubled how many people are playing online cards.
It's amazing. I mean, this is a great time. This is literally the second poker boom. And so we're talking about, okay, all these recreational players just like sitting at home. They're like, shoot, I need to gamble. I'm going to go play online poker. I mean, the games are softer now than they have been since pre-2011. And so that's one reason why you probably should play, because it's not just filled with like, you know, sick regs and stuff like
grinders.
That. Also, yeah. But, you know, also, you know, you're stuck in your house. What else is there?
I wonder if there is any movement on a federal level to repeal parts of the UIGEA. I mean, we've already seen parts of the UIGEA peeled back, right? Like we've already seen sports betting, like, and like this is something that's already happening during quarantine, during the coronavirus, is, you know, like the Nevada Board of Gaming or whatever it's called is like started to move new things to be, you know, like legal and regulated or whatever. So like it does not seem crazy or impossible that we could see legal online poker everywhere, every state as a result of this.
I mean, it is possible. The reality is the federal government moves pretty glacially, and we still don't all have coronavirus tests, so I'm not going to hold my breath on that. But certainly an event like this and a down economy sets the stage for something that like that to potentially happen. I'm not smart enough or know enough about like the way politics works to like know if that's likely or not, but I would say it's more likely than it was, but still like way under 50% to happen.
All right, so some of the biggest differences between playing live and online, because the last time that we talked, we were mostly talking about your experiences playing live in the Bay Area. And, you know, there are some pretty critical differences between the two. Even like same stakes, same game, doesn't matter. Pretty big differences between playing live and online, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the reality is if you, I mean, and we were talking about this before the podcast started, if you're playing 2-5 live and step into a 2-5 online game, I mean, the skill level's way, way higher. Like the skill level at like, whatever, I don't know, 25 cent, 50 cent is about the same as 5-10, something like that. I'm just kind of pulling that out of my tail. But the thing that makes up for it is that you see a whole lot more hands online. Like generally at tables online, you're seeing 75 hands per hour on average, as opposed to like 30 live.
And you can play 4 tables. You can play 4 tables. You can play 12 tables if your online provider allows for it.
Absolutely. But think about that. Like if you're playing 4 tables, you can see 300 hands an hour as opposed to 30 live. So you can play with 1/10 of the stack. If you're used to playing for $1,000, you can play for $100 instead, and you see 10 times the hands, but you're playing for 1/10 of the money. You're basically playing at the same stakes. You know what I mean? So online is just like way more efficient. You're not sitting around waiting for people to finish their fried rice at the table or the dealer to chuckle
right,
it up with the guy.
Just the worst, right?
It's the worst, yeah.
Just like thinking about like sitting at most of the live poker I've played has actually been in Oklahoma, because I go down there every Christmas with my family, and there's a casino, you know, relatively close to my grandparents' place. And a lot of the times I will just go, like when I was in college and stuff, I would just leave and go play cards at night and stuff. And I'm just like thinking of just the, you know, the truckers, the toothless old ladies, just like, just like
Bob the truckers in there, like
just
jamming
and
it
I
in
just,
with, yeah.
Well, it just like, and everyone's limping, right? Everyone just is calling. Everyone just calls in, and then they get mad at you when you raise.
Yeah, they it's like an affront. I mean, and that's a big difference too, right? Live games, there's so much limping and calling and not much three betting. When you go into online games, you will see very little limping. You'll see much more three betting. The game is way, way, way different. And so if you can find a game where there's like live players playing online, you know, like a private game where live players are going to play, that's kind of like what you're looking for right now.
Yeah. So like what are, I mean, I guess for sure one of the big differences is just that people are on average going to be like more aggressive, right? Just like more willing to go all in, just like for like really basic reasons of like it takes 3 seconds to rebuy and you don't have to drive home when you're done. You know what I mean? Like if you get stacked off, you can just like go watch a movie on Netflix or whatever. It takes three seconds. Yeah.
And let me tell you, it takes a lot less courage to move that slider over and click all in than it does to put out a mountain of chips, like $1,500, and push it into the middle with air, right? It takes a lot less courage to do it online than it does live. And so you see a lot more bluffing online than you do live.
Yeah, that is, it's just definitely true. So I guess, so talking about No Limit Hold'em, how many people do you think are playing with like heads up displays or some sort of tool while they are playing?
Yeah, so I think most of the regulars are people who regularly play on there. If you click on a guy's name and it says he's from Belarus or the Russian Federation or Sweden, that guy's got a heads up display. And for those that don't know what that is, basically you can have a poker database that like catalogs hands for you. And then it'll put a player's statistics in front of them. And it'll tell you, hey, this guy is playing 23% of his hands and he's raising 18% of them and he's three betting 7%. It will literally give you a mathematical computation of what this player's been seen doing. And you can start getting like quote unquote reads on his play, his patterns by how often he's doing things with certain frequencies. I don't like that stuff because I think one of the things that makes poker really awesome is having the instinct for the other players. And I mean, personally, I think it's one of the things I'm good at with poker. And so I don't like the fact that a like not very instinctual person can just have a statistical readout of your frequencies and use that instead of like using his own mind to do it. So I am doing my best to play on sites that don't allow heads up displays. And I think if you don't have one, you should seek to play on sites that don't allow them.
So I think that there is a big element of like, when you're playing live, you can use a lot of different elements to get reads. You can try and play like more exploitatively.
Yeah.
Whereas I think that's a lot harder online overall. Like it's harder to play in a way where you're taking advantage of information you know about your opponent that either they're not controlling for or that they don't know that they're giving off or whatever. Whereas, you know, a lot of the times it seems like you'd be better off just playing like, you know, the math-based approach to these decisions.
Yeah, I mean, generally the best way to play is to have a strong fundamental frequency-based, math-based approach to the game and then start veering off of it as you find weaknesses in your opponents. And like you said, live, it's way easier to find those exploits. If some dude's drunk as shit on your table live, you can tell he's drunk as shit immediately, right?
Right.
When you're playing online, you have no idea if the guy's doing meth while, you know, playing No Limit Hold'em. But if the guy's got three teeth and big old dilated eyeballs on your table, he's on meth, you know? It's just like,
right.
So you can get those reads very, you know, just the way people handle their chips, the way they talk about poker. You can get a lot of information.
Yeah, number one fish tell. Oh, I folded the trip. So like, you know, like
four, I had eight deuce. I would have flopped the boat.
Like, right. Yeah. Like cool that, story, that is the number one poker tell that exists. Like if you don't know that, like if you're that guy who says that, just know like that is utterly the most extreme. You know, it's just about as bad as it gets in terms of tells of being a fish.
Yeah, that easy fish behavior. So you can absolutely like tell that stuff just within 3 minutes being live with somebody. But online, you know, it takes all you're really recognizing is betting patterns. And so it takes a while for those betting patterns to kind of come into focus where you have a good picture of, you know, what the guy's doing. So online, it's a little tougher and you should stick mostly to a game theory kind of setup until you figure out what the weaknesses of the players are.
All right. Some of the biggest mistakes that you believe people to be making right now, in you know, kind of small stakes, mid stakes, online cash games.
Number one, they don't bluff enough. Number two, they don't three bet enough. Number three, they play way too many hands pre-flop. You know, I mean, that's just it. They play too many hands and they play them like limp noodles, as opposed to playing good hands and just like playing them like a G. I mean, that's going to separate the good players from the bad players mostly right now.
So I think you should explain why playing for more bluffs is profitable, because it makes sense when you hear it, you know, spoken out or whatever, but it's not immediately, like, the way I understand it, it takes a little bit to understand why it's true.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, I'd say the two big reasons to make bluffs, and let me just qualify this. Every player bluffs, right? What I mean is everybody, like when they raise preflop and they miss the flop, they'll continuation bet. Or they will, you know, on the river when they've been drawing to a flush and they miss and somebody checks them, they'll bluff the river. Everybody takes shots. These are bluffs. But most players don't run bluffs. And what I mean about running bluffs is like big, multi-street, multi-barrel, big boy bluffs. That's the kind of bluff I'm talking about. And so the reasons you would do that, I think the two major reasons is, number one, to earn the right to get paid on your big hands, right? If you're only like going raise, preflop, bet flop, bet turn, bet river when you have like an ace hand, you haven't earned the right to get paid, right? People can just fold to you because the only time you take that line is when you have a freaking monster. So you should do that sometimes when you don't have monsters. And then the other reason is that the mathematics of poker dictate it. So you were talking earlier about pot odds, right? Oh yeah, I'm, you know, 33% to make my flush and there's this much in the pot, whatever. The way that I've really started to use pot odds is in bluffing, right? Like say on the river, the pot's $500 and you bet 500 into it with a bluff. That means that you only have to be good on your bluff 50% of the time or more, right? And so you, if you have information that says that you will get this bluff through 60, 70% of the time, this bluff is insanely plus EV. It is insanely profitable over the long term. It's laying you the right play.
So we got to go even further back, and we got to explain the concept of, well, we're going to go two layers back. First is the reason why you have to bluff sometimes and why you have to win pots basically where you don't have the best hand is it's just very unlikely that you're going to have the best hand often enough to make that much money, right?
It's like
you're
just make hands.
Yeah, it's hard to make top pairs, you know what I mean? Like, so it's really unlikely that you're gonna go sit down, okay, I'm gonna go play for 3 hours and you know, over that time frame I'm gonna make the nuts four times and I'm gonna get paid every time.
Right, yeah. Good luck with that.
Right. If you're lucky, you'll get paid, you'll hit a set and you'll get paid once, like at a session, right?
Oh yeah. Like if that happens, you're
and you pumped. And you better not run bad on that hand. You better not run into quads on that hand. So just to be profitable and to, like, you know, have money coming into your stack so you're not just paying the blinds and the rake the whole time that you're playing, you gotta be able to win bluff. So that's like the very first level of why you need to be bluffing more than you are. I think the second level is like the concept of equilibrium, where like this is always profitable or you're indifferent to doing this, right? Because like in poker, it's not like things can be right 100% of the time. Like nothing is really right 100% of the time because it's no limit hold'em.
Correct. And so what you're talking about is equilibrium being balanced. So take my example of there being $500 in the pot on the river and you bluff 500 into it. Your bluff needs to be profitable 50% of the time or more, but think of it from your opponent's perspective. Now he's getting 2-1, right? Because there's 500 in the pot and you bluffed 500. So there's 1,000 in the pot and it costs him 500. So that means he's getting 2-1. And so theoretically what equilibrium means to make his choice indifferent over the long term is that you need to be doing this with 66% value and 33% bluffs, right? You need to be weighted at 2-1 so that if he calls every time or he folds every time, it's the same. He's indifferent. And he is not going to hit those frequencies right. He's gonna call too much or fold too much, and you gain value when he does either of those things if you're perfectly balanced. Now, is it easy to bluff exactly 1/3 of the time on the river and value bet exactly 2/3 of the time? No, it's very, very difficult to figure that out. And it takes a lot of study on how to do that. But that's what you're talking about. Pure GTO, pure equilibrium balance. That's what that is.
So I think that there's an even easier, like less brainy way to explain that.
No way.
Yeah. Which is that there are going to be some hands you play where your cards are never best, right? You're sitting, you're on the river and you have queen high and you'll never ever make money with a check or a call. So those are zero, the EV of those hands are like cents, right? Like maybe queen high wins against 10 high on like a weird drawy board or something. But if the line has been taken correctly, so if the hand plays out in such a way, your bluff actually does have EV and your bluff Correct. Only has to work 20, 30, 35% of the time or whatever in order to be like a profitable decision. So like that's to me, as someone who's not that good at math, is the way to understand why, like, 'cause actually river bluffing when you like are learning about poker is like supposed to be terrible, right? They're like, oh, never bluff on the river because you'll just get called. But actually, people don't like to make huge calls on the river unless they have, you know, top pair, two pair set, whatever.
And those hands are really hard to make.
So it's hard to make top pair, dude. It's really hard.
So you got to take advantage of the fact that it's hard to make good hands, you know? Like, it is a straight crime if you, like, check the river and the guy checks back and he's got, like, third pair and wins the pot. Like, you just should slap yourself. And it's shameful. Like, I can't sleep at night when I play pots like that. So I aim to not play pots like that.
So I think another – have we talked – we haven't really talked about ranges at all. People are probably so mad. They're like, Davis sucks at poker. Why is he talking about this? But, like, I'm not trying to claim that I'm good, but I do, like – just like DFS and stuff, I just like think it's really interesting and I like to play it. So like I think another big difference from Moneymaker years to now is range advantage is huge. And like thinking about like, okay, who's likelier to have the better cards? Not like, oh, I put you on Ace King. Like that's something that like guys would have said on the World Series of Poker broadcast in 2007, like, oh, I put him on Ace King, so correct. X, Y, and Z. Like, no smart poker player would ever speak that way these days.
No, I think that's exactly right. And range advantage is a big way that you're going to find out the best opportunities to make these big bluffs. So that's a really good point. And what Davis is talking about with range advantage is like, just say you raise with Ace King, or just say you raise in early position and somebody on the button calls your raise. You have the range advantage because you have the aces and the kings and the queens and the Ace King and the Ace Queen suited in your range because your range should be tight in early position and you raised. Whereas he just called in late position, he's playing a wider range. So his good hands are diluted within that range. And then also he would generally three bet with aces and kings and queens and stuff like that. So when he doesn't, it doesn't mean that he never has aces or kings, like sometimes people trap, but what it means is generally the preflop raiser who is in earlier position has way more of those hands on a frequency basis than the late position guy. And so you can start wielding the range advantage to your advantage as the hand progresses, understanding that you have the nuts in your range and he doesn't.
So that is, yeah, and okay, so that is, again, another key touchstone of trying to play poker right now, which is just that, like, if you don't have the ability to create the best possible hand or the best possible hand, it's probably not mega ideal to be getting loads and loads of money in the pot. Like you don't want to be going in for stacks with you know bottom pair or even top pair like unplayable kicker like ace four on ace 8-6 like that's you're not trying to get stacks in at that point.
Yeah, I mean at that point, if stacks go in, all you have is a bluff catcher, right? You're not beating any hand that would legitimately go all in for value. So you just have the middle of a range. Whereas the person going all in generally has a polarized range. They either have a really, really awesome hand or they have like queen high, like Davis was talking about, and they're trying to get it through. So those hands are on the spectrums and your hand's in the middle. So yeah, you're in a tough spot.
Yeah. So, you know, overall, not great. Any other, you know, I'm just kind of thinking of like basic points that I don't know, I wish I would have started talking to someone with when I started playing online again.
Well, we can talk a little bit about, you know, we talked about the range advantage. What that kind of leads into is capped ranges. And so what capped ranges mean is that your opponent generally doesn't have an awesome hand. And like a really easy example of this is like, you know, a flop comes with two spades on it and you bet the flop and he calls. And then the turn comes a scary card and you bet again and he just calls. Generally, his range is capped there because if he had a monster hand like a set or a straight, he would raise on the turn because he's afraid of getting drawn out on, the board's scary, he wants to get more money in with his good hand. So when they don't raise the turn on like scary boards, generally what you'll find is that their range is capped. Like they don't have the nuts and you can take advantage of them not having the nuts because people don't want to stack off without the nuts. So then you can start putting pressure on people in that regard.
Yeah, I think that is true. Okay, do we want to talk about some of our favorite poker books before we talk about bluffing, or do you want to talk about bluffing first?
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about books a little bit. I mean, I want to say, like, I'm not super well read, but I know you've been. I mean, I'm not in the last couple years, I should say. But I know you've been kind of mashing a bunch of poker books lately.
Just don't have anything to do. You know what I mean?
I record poker casts and play on unregulated poker sites and read books.
Yeah. So I think the best book that I would recommend to folks would be Andrew Brogess's Play Optimal Poker. That seems to be, so not only did I think that it was very good in introducing like this new way of thinking about cards, but like all the people on 2+2 and you know, like all the reviews I read of it are like, this is the book that explains the new wave of, you know, poker 5.0 or whatever, you know, like explaining how the game works now.
Okay, so I actually haven't read that book. Tell me what your, like, one or two aha concepts you took away from it that you were like, oh, snap, that makes so much sense. Why haven't I been thinking about things like this?
I mean, basically, he goes into the very, like, he explains game theory and, like, equilibrium and, you know, doing things to maintain or not maintain equilibrium on purpose. Like, he uses a bunch of, like, toy games. Like very basic, like poker games where you could, like, all that exists is ace, king, and queen, and essentially,
right, the three card game. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So I would say the most impressing thing from the book, the thing that I took away most from it, and like this is very like you know, poker 101, but just like playing in position, so being last to act post flop is far and away the biggest advantage you can have playing cash. Like if you're not even that good, or if you don't have great cards, like just playing in position just gives you a much greater chance of winning the pot, because you gain information that your opponent does not have when they're making their decision.
It's so huge that you can understand just how huge position is and you're still underestimating it. I mean, that's just, it's almost the whole game. And so theoretically, like, you should be folding a ton of hands out of position. Dude, you see hands that you love, 7-6 suited and, you know, jack 9 suited and all these fun ace jack and, you know, all these fun hands that, like, out of position, you're just going to get walloped on. They're not good enough. But in position, they can be monsters. It changes everything.
Yeah, it is. So, like, you know, like, so another thing that extrapolates from that is, like, you got to have like better than under the gun hands to play in the small blind. Like you got, like, if you are playing out of the small blind, you got to have aces, kings, queens, ace, king, jacks. And like,
and,
I don't know.
And some bluffs.
Yeah. I'm not balancing my range that much right now. I'm folding. I'm probably playing 10% of my hands out of the small blind right now. Like I'm playing super nitty.
Yeah, I'm actually not opposed to that, because that's the position you should be the tightest in, but certainly you should be fighting back with like certain three bet bluffs pre-flop.
Does that make sense? Well, and also just like three betting in general seems like you should be doing it. Like if you're willing to play in the hand, a lot of the times you should probably be willing to make that third bet pre-flop.
Yeah, well, and especially when you're in a disadvantageous position post-flop, like the small blind. And so you have these in-between hands like ace 4 suited and ace 5 suited, where it's like, I don't want to fold this hand. But at the same time, if I just call, like, dude, I have one good card in my hand. I'm out of position against a player with aggression. I'm screwed. These are really good hands to start 3-bet bluffing with, because A, they have an ace blocker in them. Meaning that it's less likely that your opponent has nut hands like aces, ace king, ace queen, etc. And then also they can flop a decent amount of equity on like hidden boards, like those low card boards. So yeah, you should start incorporating those kind of bluffs and have kind of a polarized range, if that makes sense. Like really good hands and then some like bottom hands in the range, as opposed to like those middle strength hands. Yeah, that makes sense.
All right, let's talk about bluffing. You have some hands.
I do. So I thought this would be fun. So I'm talking about like running these big bluffs. And I thought just some examples that I've played. I have three of them. I thought would like at least help illustrate it for people, like what you should be looking for when you're running big bluffs. Because, like, let's just take a big picture example. What good players do when they run bluffs is they mimic their lines that they take with big hands. Like, for example, again, you raise an early position with ace king and the button calls. And the flop comes ace 7-2. You bet the flop and they call. And the turn's a 10 and you bet and they call. And the river pairs the deuce and you bet again. You bet all three streets because you have top pair, top kicker. But then what most players do, say in the same example, they have king queen and it comes ace 7-2. What most players do is they bet the flop, they c bet it, and they get called. And then the turn comes the 10 and they check. That's so easy to play against. You know, it's just like, okay, when they have it.
Yeah, I didn't hit my X, Y, and Z, so.
Right. And that's just a terrible way to play poker because good players can just float you with any two cards on the flop and then take it away when you check to them. So the reality is you can't just three barrel bluff though all the time. So there are certain things that you should look out for when you're trying to three barrel bluff. And I have these things, I just kind of made some notes about what I think these things are. Number one is that you have the range advantage. And so we talked about that earlier. You want to be the one with the range advantage when you're bluffing, and you also want his range to be capped. Another thing that's helpful is that you want to have blockers to good hands that he would have, which basically means you want to have cards that would be good for him to have, right? You pick up outs on the turn, stacks are deep, and your image is good. If a lot of these things are true, you're going to have a good bluffing opportunity. So I have let's start with an online hand from last night. This is one I just played last night and this was fun. All right.
Let's hear it.
Okay. So we're playing 1-2 and we're $300 deep. And so there's two limps. And I have ace-queen offsuit. I have the ace of hearts and the queen of diamonds. So two players limp, I have ace-queen, and I raise to $13 at 1-2. Everybody folds except for the last limper. So now it's me and this limper, and I'm in position. And the flop comes king 8-4, with the king and the eight being spades. So it's like, who has the talk about what you think is the range advantage here, Davis.
I would think you have the range of it. Was 13 the pot size bet?
Yeah. So now there's like 30 in the pot. So I raised to 13 pre, yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, you have the range advantage. I would assume that what this guy has, like, I would assume his range is a lot of like queen 10 offsuit, ace 6 offsuit. King jack offsuit, like probably maybe like 7-6 suited, stuff like that.
Yeah, a bunch of bullshit ass hands, right?
Right.
Like he doesn't have pocket aces, he doesn't have pocket kings, he doesn't have ace king, right? So I have the range advantage, I have the nut advantage. Again, it's king 8-4 with the king and the eight of spades. I bet 13 and he check calls. The turn comes the jack of clubs. So now it's king 8-4 jack with two spades. He checks. I overbet the pot. I bet 60. Now I've picked up a gutter with my ace king or with my ace queen, right?
You love it.
I love to see it, right?
I mean, like, so that's another thing is like, again, you learn like, oh, like, you know, Harrington on Hold'em, like, you know, don't chase gut shots, but actually because you're trying to maintain like some equity when you're called, that's like it's like mathematically meaningful right. to be able to pick those up.
Yeah, I'm not chasing a gut shot, you know what I mean? Like if I end up making it, great, but I'm not playing my hand. I'm only playing the hands that he doesn't have. I'm attacking his weak range. And the other thing is we talked about blockers, right? It's king 8-4 jack. I don't have, you know, I have an ace and a queen, so I'm blocking hands like king queen. they're much less likely.
Well, we didn't talk about blockers at all. That's like again, that's a huge new poker thing in you know, the year of our Lord 2020.
It is. I'll just say a quick thing. There's a king on board in this example, and I have a queen in my hand. So that means there's three kings left and three queens left. That means that there's nine ways that he can have king queen, which is a hand that I don't want him to have. If I didn't have a queen, there's three kings and four queens, which means 12 available combos. Basically, when I have a queen in my hand, it decreases the chance of him having a queen by 25%, which is a nice edge in my favor. So king queen is like the hand that I'm worried about, right? Because that's a pretty good hand, but you know, I help block that. So again, I bet 63 into 56 bucks and he calls again. So the river comes the eight of hearts, which pairs the eight. So now the board is king 8-4 with two spades on the flop, jack of clubs on the turn, eight of hearts on the river. I've completely missed. He checks and I shove all in for 211. And he takes his whole time bank and he ends up folding. Why was this a good bluff? Well, again, I had the range advantage. I blocked ace king and king queen because I have an ace and a queen. So he can't have pocket kings, pocket jacks, ace king. There's no set of eights because the eight paired on the river, right? So there's only one way he could have quads. We're 150 big blinds deep. It's just hell for him to call me here because his range is capped, right? If he had like a set or top two pair or something on the turn, he would have check raised. So he's like capped at one pair and it's like, screw you, buddy. We're going to the felt. Like, do you have the stones to call when you don't have the nuts?
What do you think he even had?
I think in this case, he probably had Jack X of spades.
Yeah. Jack nine of spades would be. I buy that.
So he had a flush draw on the flop. He made a pair on the turn. So he felt like he couldn't fold even to an overbet. And then on the river, he completely bricked out and I just shoved for more than pot. And he's like, damn, this guy could have aces, kings, ace king, and he folds, right? So I think that was his most likely hand. Maybe he had like king 10 and he's just like, shit, I'm just dead here. I'm folding it. But at the end of the day, who cares? It's not about what he had. It's just about what he didn't have. And so that's the story of that bluff.
So that is, I think, a really instructive example of a point where most people would have just they maybe would have been fine barreling once with ace queen. Maybe when it was checked to them on the turn, they do it again, but they don't fire the river bluff. They're just like, well, you know, this guy has ace jack, and this guy has ace jack off, and he's gonna call.
Yeah. And sometimes you have to have that courage, man. It's tough, but at the end of the day, you have to be the one driving the action. You have to, I mean, there's a lot of money in that pot. How could I possibly check that down and let like a pair of jacks win the hand? Like, you just can't allow it to happen. Like, you need to put people in tough spots. And the reality is I earned a lot of money, right? He put in money on the flop and the turn and then folded the river. That's a mathematical disaster for him, which means it was really great for me.
Right. Yeah. I tend to agree with that. Yeah, for sure. Okay. Do we have more hands?
Yeah, we do. We have two more and I'll try to go in quick. But you'll like the last one. I think it'll be fun. So the second one, this was a couple months ago. I was playing 5-10 live. And so we're $1,100 effective. So 110 big blinds. Under the gun and middle position, both limp for 10. I raised to 60 bucks with king queen offsuit from the cutoff, which is
when wild. Someone limps, do you just assume they're bad?
Yes.
I feel, obviously that can't be true that everyone who limps in these games is bad at cards, but like, it's like the number one, like it, to me, it says that they never read a poker book or something, because every book, every forum post, whatever, will just be like, never limp.
Right. And the other thing they're doing when you limp is they're capping their own range already. Like, they can't have pocket aces here. If they play pocket aces, like as a limp call, in general, like, dude, they are playing pocket aces all wrong. You know what I mean?
It's just like it's so much harder for you to get all the money in when you're limp, because it's just the more money that is bet on the way to the river, the more likely that all the money will get in at the river.
Right. So, like, do people limp with aces occasionally? Yes.
Yeah.
But, like, do they generally? No. And is that the right way to play aces? Theoretically, no. So, at the end of the day, they are already capping their own ranges when they limp preflop. They have suited connectors and small pairs the majority of the time. They have queen-jack offsuit the majority of the time. They're just telegraphing that they don't have top end of range. And if you have an aggressive player that recognizes that you already don't have top of range, buddy, you're in for a world of hurt. Like, good players are going to take advantage of that. So don't do it. Okay.
All right, so let's continue with the hand. You have what?
I have king, queen, offsuit. I have king of hearts, queen of diamonds. So red, king, queen, I raise to 60, and both of those limpers call. So two limps, I raise to 60 with king, queen. They both call. The flop comes 9-4-3 with the 9 and the 3 of clubs. So there's a club flush draw. It's 9-4-3. They both check. I continuation bet 90, and the under-the-gun player calls. The turn comes the jack of diamonds. So what do I pick up, Davis?
You backdoored the draw. That's what you need.
I backdoored a gutter draw, right? So now it's 9-4-3 jack with two clubs. So he checks again, and I bet 220 into 360, and he check calls again. So when you have this kind of board, Davis, 9-4-3.
This dude just has got to have like ace queen offsuit, right? No, but he limped.
He limped. So he has a lot of flush draws, right?
That's such a weird clubs. Line to take.
He has some 9x, like 9-10 suited, 9-8 suited. So he's not quite ready to give it up because he thinks he puts me on ace king. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, 9-4-3, and then the jack on the turn, he's going to hang on with a pair of nines. He's going to keep coming along with flush draws. And so that's the kind of range that I kind of put him on here. The other thing is we talk about blockers. I have a red king queen, which means that I unblock clubs. I wouldn't want to have clubs in my hand here because I want him to have the club flush draw. So because I don't have any clubs, it's more likely that he does, which puts him on a drawing hand.
Right.
So the river, so he check calls again, and the river comes the deuce of diamonds. So it's 9-4-3 on the flop with two clubs, jack of diamonds, two of diamonds. He checks, and I jam all in 730 with king, queen, high into 800 bucks, and he folds. So again, this was good, kind of for the similar reasons as the first one. I unblock clubs, so we talked about that. I can have big pairs. I can have aces, kings, queens here.
You have, just because he played every step passively, that just says, I'm on a draw that doesn't get there.
Right. If he had a set, wouldn't he check raise the turn? You know what I mean? Almost nobody just check calls.
Some people online do. Some people will do is they will, if they know, like if you bet into them, well, okay, come back. Okay. Some people will limp with eights, with twos, with threes, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then it is a very popular online strategy to check if you hit a set and let someone bet into you.
Sure.
And good players
will you do it for three streets?
No. So, but he checked to you on the river cause you were in position.
Right.
So I have had this happen to me where I've sent king, queen high into, you know, a set of eights or whatever.
Right.
Again, surprising no one. because if you put yourself in the let's say this guy limps and calls with eights and you barrel him once, so you raise and then you flop it and you're like, okay, I'm gonna slow play it, and I check, and then you bet again. It's got to be close to equilibrium if he thinks that you are gonna, like, if he thinks that you're gonna bet again, he should check to you on the turn for sure. It's just a matter of if he thinks he should check to you or not.
Right. And it's a tough situation for him because say I did have a hand that he wants to have a set against. Say I have pocket queens. He's got to worry about an ace or a king falling on the river. He has to worry about a club falling on the river that'll ruin his action. There's a lot of bad cards for a set to just.
Yeah, I don't know what does he want you. I guess he wants you to either be bluffing or to have like ace nine. Oh yeah, over pair probably.
Right. So that's the big thing is like, it's not that he'll never have a set here. It's just that he's very unlikely to. Again, we're never dealing with 100% probability here. We're just like playing the odds here, and in general, he's going to be capped at like one pair. He's going to have a pair of nines. He's going to have, you know, a missed flush draw. But I can't check back and hope that king queen high is good and he wins with ace high flush draw. Like, I cannot allow this to happen. I need to bluff the river. And so he quickly folded in that hand. So again, it satisfied the range advantage, the unblockers in this case, the fact that we're deep, the fact that I can make a big bet on the river that's like pot size that he'll fold a lot of hands to, et cetera. So that's a good one. And the last one I think you'll like.
That's one, by the way, where I would maybe not send the third one. Yeah. Where I would, because there are a lot of slow played hands that can get you there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes you will get snapped off and it hurts, but
when someone checks to you and you shove and they're just, and they it doesn't even like your chips aren't even in the middle by the time they've called, like,
hey, let me tell you something, buddy. Sometimes gunfighters get shot. And again, this isn't one of these things where this is always going to work out. You just need it to work out 50% of the time or more. Or if your shove at the end is half the pot, you know what I mean? Like, it only needs to work, whatever, a quarter of the time or more, a third of the time. You know what I mean? A third of the time or more. So it just has to work enough. It does not have to work every time. And that's what we're going to talk about in this third one. Okay.
All right, so let's do it.
This is from 2-5 Live, and we're about, we're about $850 deep, so 170 big blinds. This weak-ass recreational player opens from middle position to 20, and it folds around to me in the small blind, and I call with queen-jack of diamonds. And then the big blind calls too. Was this a good idea to call? I'm certainly not folding the hand. Should I 3-bet it? Maybe I should have.
You have queen jack suited?
Yeah, queen jack suited. Queen jack of diamonds.
We're in what position?
I'm in the small blind. This guy open raised from middle position.
I would just fold.
You nit. Well, I can't knit it up like that. But anyway, I call the 20 and the big blind calls the 20. So all three of us are in for 20, the pot $60, and the flop comes 7 of diamonds, 5 of hearts, 3 of diamonds. So 7-5-3 with 2 diamonds. I have 2 overs and a flush draw. I like this hand.
So I think big blind has the range advantage here, cuz I think he's got more like 6-8 suited, fives. Like, I think he's got the range advantage on both of you.
Yeah. So he has, yeah, we kind of call that the nut advantage. And I think that's absolutely true. So we need to kind of watch out. This board misses the preflop raiser a lot, right? This is not a good board for him. If he's got an overpair, he's pretty happy. But for the majority of
ace king, ace queen hates this board.
Exactly. So I check and the big blind checks and the preflop raiser continuation bets 35 into 60 on this 7-5-3 2 diamond board. I check raise to 110. And the reason I check raise is for the reasons that we talked about. This flop, 3 coordinated low cards, is generally a better board for the weak caller than it is for the middle position raiser, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And it's also, like, I'd want to check raise with sets, so I need to find some bluffs in here. And good flush draws tend to satisfy that. Like, I'm going to want to check call with, like, 7-8 suited and pocket eights and, you know, 5-6 and 5-4 pairs with a, you know, I want to check call a lot of those hands. So I need to find some hands to check raise with along with my nutted hands. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
And also this board, this check raise should put a ton of pressure on the big blind to fold, which he does. And then it should make the preflop raiser, he's a weak player, he should fold pretty much everything except overpairs and like big flush draws, which I block. So that's why this is a good check raise in my mind. But he thinks for a while and ends up calling my check raise. And
never good if someone calls your check raise, by the way. If someone calls your check raise, like, they have some sort of draw, or like they have something to get to the nuts.
That is correct. And so he, you know, I have queen jack of diamonds, so he can really only have like ace king of diamonds, ace 10 of diamonds, ace 9 of diamonds,
ace blank of diamonds.
Right, but there's not, but I block a lot of flush draws that he can have. So generally he's got some bigger flush draws, and then he's got over pairs most of the time, right? So I'm not going to barrel this turn again unless the card's really good for me, because he's probably going to keep calling. If it's like the 10 of clubs, like, this is just not a good situation to keep bluffing. But the turn is the 6 of spades. So now it's 7-5-3-6 with two diamonds. And this is a really, really good card for me, because if he's got an overpair, dude, he is in such a sick spot. I only need 1-4 in my hand for a straight. I can have two pairs. I can have sets. Dude, I can have all sorts of hands, and he's basically capped at like one pair, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is a great card, and I'm like, well, screw it. I'm going to keep barreling. So I bet 160 into 280, expecting him to call most of the time, and then I'm going to get him off it on the river. So he does check call, and then the river's a complete blank. It's the two of spades. So it flops 7-5-3, two diamonds, six of spades on the turn, two of diamonds on the river. He checks, and I jam 575 into 590, about a pot size bet. Screw your overpair, buddy. You can't call this. This is a big live bet. And what do you think he does, Davis?
I would assume he calls. I would assume, like, the guys, like, you think, like, oh, you can't call, but guess what? They can, like, first of all, if someone has aces and you're like, I think this guy has aces or kings, the board could literally be a straight flush from like 2 to 6 of a straight flush, and like the guy's like gonna have a hard time actually folding it.
Yeah. So he does snap it off, and he's got 7-6 of clubs. He made top two pair on the turn. And I lost.
And this
all my
was
money.
this was the not the big blind.
No, this was the pre-flop raiser. So what ended up happening is he had a part of his range that I thought
That's why you have the balanced range, or actually this isn't a balanced range. That's a super polarized range, because like the only thing he can have is the nuts or 7-6 suited.
Yeah, and 7-6 suited isn't even the nuts. Like, honestly, it still loses to straights and sets. I mean, it's more of a bluff catcher than anything, but you know, the reality is he ended up having the hand that time, and I lost $850, 170 big blinds. The point is, these don't always work out. You can, you know, put all the odds in your favor and do everything and have the nut advantage and, you know, all this stuff and be balanced. And at the end of the day, sometimes you will get snapped off. It's okay, right? I think it's one of Sklansky's sayings. You know, it's like, if you never get caught bluffing, you're not bluffing enough.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need to get all these through. You only need to get a third of them or half of them through, depending on your sizing on the river, to be overall profitable. And you should be looking for these things like range advantage, nut advantage, blockers, et cetera, to guide you.
to get snapped off by 7-6 sometimes. Just, I mean, sometimes that's the way it is.
It is. I mean, like I said, sometimes gunfighters get shot. And, you know, if you want to play this game, you have to be willing to get it all in and lose, because you know that over the long term, these plays will be profitable, but they don't always work. Like,
it's sort of like playing Alvin Kamara over Leonard Fournette in cash.
How just dare because, you?
You know, just because Leonard Fournette outscored Alvin Kamara 1 week doesn't necessarily mean that playing the fat, slow guy over Alvin Kamara was in fact the proper, you know, move.
You don't like big target shares and touch shares. You know, sometimes you just run good, Davis. That's all I got to say. Even if everything goes wrong for you in poker or DFS, sometimes it's great to just suck out and get lucky. So you should try doing that too.
What do you think is harder to be good at, DFS or poker?
Poker.
Yeah, I think poker is so much harder.
Yeah, at the end of the day, it's so much more intricate. Like, you are controlling a lot of the action, right?
Well, you can't talk to anyone. You can't right. be making a decision and be like, you can't look at a projection, or you can't
Slack your rich friends and ask them what they're doing right. in cash.
Yeah, or you can't be like, checking injury reports and stuff. Like, they're just, your decision making is just what your brain has got in it in like the 60 seconds you're thinking about it.
Yeah, DFS is a lot like going all in pre-flop and just like saying, okay, I'm going to go all in with this hand and I have an edge, and then everything just happens, but it's out of your control. Whereas right. poker, you're still influencing action throughout the game on the flop and the turn and the river. Obviously, the cards are out of your control, but you influence the betting action. Whereas in DFS, except for like late swap, once the game starts, you're kind of just like, whatever happens, happens. And you're just trying to get these small edges pre-flop, you know? So it's, I'd say poker for sure.
Yeah, I think that is likely true. If the people enjoyed us talking about cards, maybe we can do more cards chat soon.
Buddy, I got nothing else to do.
We got it. Maybe we should have someone, we should talk to someone who's like good at PLO or something.
Oh yeah. I have no idea what's what at PLO. And honestly, no, I mean, honestly, me they're, you should have Joe Ingram on, man. Like the great game, like he would come on, talk about the Galfond challenge with him. Like he would do it all bit.
Yeah, I mean, if maybe I'll try and get a hold of him. I think he is great, and I love his stuff. So that would be awesome if he came on.
And you can talk to him about content creation, like, and then have Josh Reynolds on next. I mean, this could be a big buddy.
Josh Reynolds doesn't have anything going on. He's got to come on.
I mean, that's all there is to it. I think I'm setting you up for success here, buddy.
All right. Well, hey, thanks for coming on, dude.
Cheers, man. Go run good.
We need to get a Gilcast, obviously a quarantine Gilcast. So we need to think about, I want to play Lawden Thinks with you and Nate. I think it would be very fun.
I think it would be fun to have Nate on the show doing yes. Lawden Thinks. Yeah. Yes. People would get a big kick out of him.
But like Nate Thinks is like literally who knows, because the guy's brain is like, oh, I'm the smartest person in the world, but also I drink 19 Red Bulls a day and then don't sleep, and I think that sleep is for the weak.
How many Red Bulls do you think Nate's drinking now?
In quarantine? This is great. Like, how many Red Bulls does Sammy think Nate drinks during quarantine? Like, that is a great Lawden Thinks.
The people will love it.
Yeah, okay. Guys, I don't know when that's coming. I'm going to literally text on our thread right now and try and set up a time for next week for us to do this, because it's going to be a great show. So look out for that, and we'll be back and chat with you guys soon.